Hey family, I'm Brian Price. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Brian.
Kind of an anecdote that I think describes our speaker, Jimmy, pretty well. My first meeting at our home group, we share a home group, and afterwards we went out to eat at a pizza restaurant. And I didn't know anybody, was real uncomfortable, but here Jimmy is. He reaches his hand out to me, gives me his number, and I see him doing that each and every week, a couple times a week. I see him at a lot of meetings, and he's always in the solution. He's became a good friend, and I look forward to hearing what he has to say.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate that. Hi, family. My name is Jimmy, and I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Hey, Jimmy.
A grateful recovered alcoholic. I can't believe I'm saying that. Because I didn't think that I could ever get out of the grips of this disease, you know? And it's good to know that the book talks about that I'm recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, you know? And it's not a cure for this disease. It's, you know, I do the things today that keep me sober today, and that's going to a lot of meetings and sponsoring guys and having friends that I call every day, and having a sponsor that takes me through the steps, you know. But I want to thank the support from my home group, and I appreciate you guys being here, and I also appreciate Jerry for asking me to do this. It is an honor to speak before you guys. They said I should start with a joke first, and I'm stealing this from somebody else. I'm not original at all. You're not unique either. There's a guy with one arm, right? And he's kind of jovial and everything. He's sitting with this young girl, and they had the DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles, before smoking was not allowed in government offices. And there's a lot of people smoking in that meeting, in the DMV, and he's just complaining about this smoke, you know. And then she turns to him, she says, "Well, at least you don't have to worry about secondhand." I know, that was cruel, right? And there was another one. Somebody else told me this. He says there was a guy that got hit by a bus, and his old left side was taken out, right? But he was all right. All right. Well, there was, my story is probably just like everybody else, hopeless and despair when I came into this program. My home group is the Fifth Tradition group, and my sobriety date is November 3rd, 2012. And I can't believe I'm saying that. But there's when I came into this into recovery this last time, I look back and I had three cars, actually four, but my friend didn't let me drive her car because I didn't do the right thing when I had her car. But I had three cars, and two of them were really disabled. But I still made the third car, which was a 91 Corolla, and it kind of went dead on 285 when I was living on Ithonia. But I still, I had this gumption that I still needed to get to the dealer, and continue my drug use, So I left the car there for a little while, and then I walked up to the QT at Covington Highway. And I got a ride from a person that just happened to be in the store, And I don't know what it connected us, but, I started crying right there before, that this is like, a prelude to me coming in this program needing help, and feeling sorry and self-pity for myself. And I knew I was doing something wrong, so I had that remorse and guilt already, You know, but she connected with me and she gave me a ride to the dealer's house, you know, and I didn't take her right to the door, you know, I told her, you know, had her ride me to around the block, and but I got there, you know, and I had just came from getting money. I borrowed money and I gave this guy this sad story, who was my best friend. I gave him this sad story, you know, why I needed this money, you know, and I got the money. I finally got to, you know, the dealer's house. And now, you know, I was relaxed then because I knew I was at home, you know. And then I wound up getting home. I had to kind of walk, I don't know, about 15 miles to get home, you know. And then I tell my girlfriend at the time, who's here, that we need to get the car from 285. And that was November 3rd. Of 2012, the next day, and we got the car, you know, and we had it towed to the house, and I was like, gosh, you know, this is kind of pitiful, you know, this is pitiful. And there's been a lot of times that I came home, you know, with my tail between my legs and knocking on the door. I couldn't get in my own house, and that was humiliating, you know, that was humiliating. That's what my life looked like coming into this program, you know. And I see now that there's a lot of things that I did because of the way that I thought. You know, we say that this disease is a disease of perception, right? And I always thought that, you know, I couldn't get along with people. You know, I couldn't get along with people that were around me. But I always tried hard to make you like me, you know. I knew there was something different about me, and I just tried so hard that, you know, I would start off and do real good, you know, get all the accolades and data boys from people. And then all of a sudden, you know, I would do something wrong and you would confront me and give me some constructive criticism, which I thought that you was really tearing me down. And I didn't, you know, then I went downhill. You know, I started doing things that would make you not like me or have to fire me or unbefriend me, yes. And do those things, you know. I didn't like being criticized. I didn't like being critiqued by anybody, you know. I didn't like my flaws being, you know, like, you know, you telling me something that you know, I was already uncomfortable with. I already knew that I was a mess up, you know, and I'll try not to curse. But I saw that as being, I'm an overachiever, you know, and I look back at that like, my parents, you know, got to the third grade. My father got to the third grade. He didn't go any further. His dad took him out of school, you know, because he played hooky one day with a friend of his, you know. And I had some resentments with my grandfather, pulling him out of school. But my mom, you know, got to the ninth grade. And I never felt comfortable with my parents, you know. And you know, they were middle class because my dad owned a brownstone in Brooklyn in the 60s. So I think he had a little money, you know. Although I saw welfare cans and cheese when I was coming up, you know, whatever they had to do to feed their family, they did it. You know, whether they were justified in doing that, I don't know. But I never knew how much my father made, or I never knew his financial situation. I know he worked for the post office, and the only way he got that job is because, you know, he was a veteran in the Korean War. But, you know, my dad stood about 5'7", you know, cock diesel, you know. Man, I was afraid of him, you know. I was definitely afraid of him, you know. I got disciplined on the regular, you know, because I was looking for that. I'm an attention seeker, guys. I like seeking attention, you know, and being an overachiever and all of that kind of stuff, that put me right in the forefront, you know. Whether I can make somebody laugh, you know, I made some people cry too because of my humor, you know, it hit right at home. I remember telling my sister, we were around the table and with the whole family around, you know, and we started talking about who went to school, who didn't graduate from high school and all of that kind of stuff. And she got a GED and she said, you know, I said, good enough for dummies, you know, and that didn't sit well with her. but you know, if I had to get a laugh at your expense, I did it, you know. and made me feel better to concentrate on your flaws, you know. I'm happy to say that I'm the only Curry that finished high school and then went on to college. You know, I just graduated from MedTech College for Medical Billing and Coding here in February of this year, you know, and I'm 54 years old, you know, and that's a big accomplishment for me. But I had a resentment because my parents didn't have the money for me to go to school when I got out of high school, so I wound up going in the Marine Corps, you know, and I didn't do a good job at that either, guys. It was right up there. I was doing well. I was platoon guide, and then all of a sudden, I did something wrong, like, you know, addressed the drill instructor, and I wasn't standing at attention, and he got on me for that, you know. And from there on, it was like, seemed like everything went downhill from there. So that's the story of my life, guys, you know. So let me tell you how it was like. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, you know, in Williamsburg, pretty Hasidic area, you know. I could tell you earlier that I would probably thought of myself as a you know, black Jew, you know, and because I was always in the synagogues, you know, and I was always, you know, having cookies and milk with these guys, you know, and playing with them and doing everything that I was, you know, that a kid would do. You know, I didn't see color. You know, I just saw these beanies and this, you know, the twirls, and I wasn't prejudiced. I didn't know color, but I was probably rebellious from early on. You know, I got my first bike, and I saw my dad kind of setting it up with my brothers in the living room, and I kind of peeked in there, you know. And then when he gave it to me on Christmas, I was like, he told me not to go off the street with this bike, you know. And the first day that I got it, you know, I mean, it was a Stingray, you know. It had the wheels and the long banana seat and everything like that, and, you know, and it was awesome. It was lime green. I don't know if that's my color, but it was lime green. And so I went off the block the first day I got the bike, and my dad wasn't home, and the bike got stolen. Needless to say, you know, and so I'm like waiting. We kind of walk back home. I mean, and I'm waiting with my family, and my dad comes home, and he just noticed that the bike wasn't there. You know, it's not like they had cell phones where they could have contacted them earlier, so he can kind of like calm down before he got there. But yeah, so the bike wasn't there, and he lost it. So that was my first beat, my first discipline with a belt. Okay, I won't say beating. I felt bad, you know. I felt bad. I disappointed my father. And I don't, you know, money was probably hard to get back then, and I lost this bike, you know. But then, you know, I have a part of my family that's gangsters, right? And this is on my mother's side. And when they found out that my bike was stolen, they knew what the bike looked like. They went out and found the bike that day, right? It was the same bike, but it's like some Mexicans or some Puerto Ricans got it, you know, and they put some ribbons on the handlebars, you know, and they kind of pimped it out, you know. They pimped it out, and I was like, wow, I got my bike back. It wasn't my bike, guys, all right? But it looked very close to it. I had the banana seat and everything. It was the same color and the whole bit, you know, and they brought it back to me, and it didn't make my father happy. I still got that beaten, you know. I still got discipline, you know. So that was the first time that I got discipline. The next time I got discipline, and I was the age of six, and at the age of seven, I was playing with matches in my father's brownstone on the third floor. It was a four-story brownstone, and I left. I hadn't even had a girlfriend then at age seven. And I went to go see her, right? And I came back to the block a couple of hours later. It was dark, and the fire department's there, everything. I was playing with matches, guys. And I pretty much displaced four families that night, you know? And my dad, I mean, he's pretty street smart. He figured it out, you know? The Red Cross put us up in a hotel and everything like that. And then I think it was 2 days later, he says, I realized who did it. You know, the arsonist, fire person said that it was, you know, due to matches, and who else would do that, you know? So I got my second discipline via belt. And that's when I took my first drink that same year. You know, I took my first drink at 7, and I got tore up drunk, right? My dad drank Ambassador Scotch, and it comes in a green bottle, right? So it's this pint, and I'm smart enough to know that if I take anything out of this, I better put it back, and I put water in it, you know, watered it down. And he pretty much knew what happened, you know, because I did everything, but, you know, I fell down the steps, I threw up, and then I was on the, you know, front porch when they got home in my own throw up, right? And, you know, and then he goes to get that drink, and he realizes somebody watered down his scotch, you know. But there was no consequences. My dad always wanted his son to be like him. I was his oldest, you know. And but because I didn't have a job, I didn't have access to the liquor, I didn't drink again until 13. And in Bob's nightmare, he talks about that, you know, his parents, from childhood through high school, I was more or less forced to go to church, you know. My higher power, who I choose to call Jehovah, you know, my mother started studying with Jehovah's Witnesses when I was 7 years old. And it was pretty much life was over as I knew it. You know, Christmas wasn't being celebrated anymore. Birthday wasn't being celebrated anymore. We don't do that, right? And so I was a pretty good kid from 7 to 13, you know. But I knew that my friends, you know, wasn't Jehovah's Witnesses. I would kind of like recreate with them. But at the same time, when the lights came on, you know, the street lights came on, I had to be like running, you know, to the house to get ready for a meeting. And there was a lot of meetings, I thought, you know, because it was like we were always, it was like 5 minutes a week, you know, that we were in a book study, we were in, you know, what we call it, Kingdom Hall. We was always there, you know, and if I wasn't in the Kingdom Hall, I was out in the ministry knocking on people's doors, telling them about God's kingdom. You know, that was my life from 7 to 13, you know. And now I feel like the prodigal son coming back, you know, because that was something that it was embedded in me, instilled in me, you know, that I had a relationship with God, you know. I got ordained at the age of 28. You know, when I came back into this program, I came in this program in 1986. And I managed to stay sober for 7 years, you know, but I had no program. Me and my sponsor, all we did was, you know, run around and make meetings at the time. You know, we never opened the book, you know, and that was, I would say that was a turning point that I could have benefited from, you know, staying sober today. I you know, I don't regret the, you know, I don't wish to shut the door. I don't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, but that was part of, you know, the thing that I'm comfortable with now. Whatever I had to go through to get here to AA, I'm here now. And I want to stay today, just for today, I want to stay. And so at the age of 13, I got a little bit rebellious. You know, I started staying out later, missing the ride to the meetings, you know. And at this time, I'm drinking Old Gold 40 Old English, you know. And I'm smoking weed, right? And I'm hanging out with my friends, and we're bugging out. You know, this. I'm running down the street in the dark, you know, thinking somebody's chasing me and there's nobody running after us. You know, those were fun times, you know. I'm doing things like having house parties in my house and crying to a poster of Chaka Khan on the wall, you know. And I'm a DJ too, so I had a lot of house parties because it was a way for me to be with my dad, you know, because he would come home, he worked the second shift, and he was coming home and he would enjoy himself with my friends, you know. And pretty much in this house, you know, there was a basement surrounded by cinder blocks, so you really couldn't hear the music upstairs, and my mother would be there. She never complained, you know, so she couldn't hear the music, but I had my dad there. And that's the thing that I always wanted, because, you know, I had a better relationship with my mom because I'd rather be in the kitchen and being domestic and baking and cooking and stuff like that, even cleaning, believe it or not. But my dad, you know, he took me to one baseball game, and it was the New York Yankees playing the Milwaukee Brewers, and it was a doubleheader, and I don't know who won, whatever, but it was bat day, and my bat was signed by Roy White, that was a good moment for me. I'm still at the age of 7, I was like, man, I did something with my dad that was memorable. And that was it. My dad was a good provider and everything. We would always come here from Georgia, to Georgia, from New York, because this is where my mother and father are from. They live in Washington. They lived in Washington, Georgia, and they moved here. I guess I was conceived here and then going back to New York. But we were always here every summer, so I knew about the South. I saw a lot of this stuff before it actually was built up. It was a lot of dirt roads here coming up in the 60s. So I did those. I did things to get my dad's attention, especially in school. The teacher would always call, your son is acting up. He did this, he did that, And my dad would, have to get out of bed in the morning to come to my school, But he heard about it because I was at school. He would be home. And when he got home that night, I would get pulled out of bed and get disciplined via belt again, So for me, that was whether it was negative attention or not, I looked at it as I was getting attention, whether it was positive or negative. And I enjoyed that my dad would have to spend time with me, I did things like put 2 pair of pants on and stuff like that to make sure they didn't hurt that much. But I still did it, And then he got smart, and then I started being naked, when he started being. But you know the deal. If you get a beating, and especially with my mom, if you scream enough, she'll stop, So I was very resourceful, and very underhanded early on in life. I learned how to get around things, But it caught up with me sooner or later. So, but I'm the father of 2 lovely girls. The one's 19 and the other one's 30, and I got 3 grandkids. And I would leave the house to go use, And they say I smoked a little crack, but the rock was this big, and that life, was, I don't know. The people that I was hanging out with wasn't people that I would hang out with on a daily basis, When I wasn't drinking, I was an okay guy to be around, But, I learned now that the disease, affected me. If I put something in my body, it was the allergy, that I couldn't stop. And I couldn't tell you when I was going to stop, And it was very progressive. It started out, maybe I spent the check, one weekend, and I was only out for 24 hours, and then it got to the point later on in my disease that it was 8 days, 5 days without sleep, away from my home, not going to work, not being responsible, leaving the house late at night. Well, my ex-wife had to be at where she was at work on the 3rd shift, go out and then come home before she got off from work, and I would be there to pick her up because she didn't have a license, and I'd be wired, wired trying to pick her up. And if, sometimes my kids woke up. Sometimes they woke up and saw that dad wasn't there, So I know that they had resentments, and I did a lot of things to my kids that hurt them, and I didn't do it intentionally, I remember another time where my daughter wanted to, spend time with her dad, and I think she was about 13 years old. This is the oldest one. And I got a tuxedo, and I was invited to the governor's ball to escort somebody, and I chose to do that. I didn't know how hurtful that was to her, And I had to make the amends to my girls, for not being there, for not being the dad I was supposed to be. For not loving myself enough. I didn't know how to love them, so how was I gonna, I didn't know how to love myself, so how was I gonna love them? That was just hard for me, But I found out later in life, what they really felt, because I wanted to raise my family different than what my father raised me as, because, kids were supposed to be seen and not heard. There was not a lot people saying I love you in my family, you know. And when I came into rehab at 28, there was I learned, you know, I gotta forgive my parents, you know, for one, for not finishing school or not having an education, you know, because I always wanted to be in somebody else's family, you know, because the neighborhood had doctors and lawyers and things of that nature. And so like I said, I never felt comfortable with my position in life, you know. And but when they dropped me off, my brother brought this shirt that said, "He's not heavy, he's my brother." And he's got, you know, somebody's walking with this person, your brother's walking with this person, you know, limbo. And that meant a lot to me. That told me that my family did love me, you know. And then so I started talking to my family a lot and saying, after I talked with them on the phone from rehab, I would say I love them after the conversation. And it took a couple of years before, you know, people got onto this. You know, it was like, okay, he's saying I love you. And before I knew it, all the family was now saying that I love you. And today it's like, you know, my kids, you know, my grandkids, my sisters, and everybody that I talk to, we end the conversation with I love you, you know. And I still don't know anything about love. I'm still trying to get to that point right now in my life where, you know, I can love myself just a little bit more. You know, I try to display that by, you know, staying sober so I can get to that point where I can love again, you know, where I can love myself to a point. But I love myself enough to know that I'm not going to put any crack or alcohol or any substances in my body, you know. There'll be no growth at that point for me, you know. I'll go back to the same person that I was, and it wasn't pretty, you know. There was a lot of things that I did to get my you know, my substance in my body, you know. This is a funny story. There was a car abandoned near the LaGuardia Airport, and so I decided, you know, I was on a run, and if I get the radio out of this car, I'm gonna be able to, you know, sell it to the dope man. And it took me about an hour and a half to get into the car, right? And then another an hour and a half to get the radio out, right? So I'm out there at this car at night, you know, trying to get this radio out. And then I walk over it and I take it to the dealer. He looked at me like I was crazy. He would not even give me one hit for it. I was like, man, after all of that time I spent to get it, you know, and it wasn't a good thing. So I wasn't a good thief at all. So that was the last time I ever attempted that, you know. So now I had to use my mind and my mouth and my brains, and I was cunning, bad, and powerful. You know, I would lie, you know, to get money. You know, usually it was my parents, and you know, I knew enough that if I asked for more than what I needed, if I needed $50, I would ask for $150, you know, because they wouldn't give it to me right away. They made me stand at the doorpost for like an hour, you know, standing there pleading with, Mom, can you give me this, can you give me that, you know, but I get it sooner or later, you know. And then it was later on, my mother just got hip to it, you know, and she just stopped giving it to me through tough love. But she enabled me for a long time. My whole family enabled me for a long time, you know. I grew up, I'm very sensitive, very, very, very sensitive. And ask anybody that knows me, you know. I'll cry at the drop of the dime, you know, watching Lifetime movies. That's me. And I realized that there was something wrong with me. You know, there was something wrong with me. I mean, I had a good life. You know, there was a lot of good times with my family. You know, but I saw that I like it says in the book. You know, I pulled the structure down all the time. I sabotaged my life. I sabotaged the relationships. You know, every relationship that I've been in after, you know, I got separated from my wife and 12 years ago. You know, two and three times I'm not relapsing, I'm slipping, I'm just using, you know. And it was like what was I going to do to keep this relationship? You know, what was I going to do to make this thing work? And I couldn't make it work. And I was coming in and out of AA, you know, and that just seemed to be my life. You know, it seemed my, you know, like a vicious cycle, you know. And because I didn't have the tools before to work this program with my sponsor that I got into this program with, and I didn't work any steps with a sponsor, I didn't know anything about this, you know, disease, you know. I didn't know that, you know, when I'm not using, I'm feeling uncomfortable, and my mind's obsessing over, you know, using again, feeling, you know, the way it made me feel, escaping reality, you know. Basically, that's what I was doing. I was just trying to escape reality until the end. You know, I just wanted to die, you know. And I was like, I remember this movie that talked about, it was Morgan Freeman, and I think it was Lean On Me, and he's got the kid at the top of the roof, and then he says, do you want to kill yourself? You know, you're killing yourself smoking that, you know, crack. You know, do you want to kill yourself? Or jump off, you know, just jump off the roof, do it expeditiously. And that's what I felt like. I felt like that kid that he was holding on to. And if somebody would have just gave me more attention when I was growing up, you know, things could have been different. There's the disease of perception, you know. My lot in life was just messed up, you know. The family I grew up in was just messed up, you know. Everything was just wrong about me, you know. And I try not to hold on to that, you know, now these days, because my life is pretty good today. You know, my life is real good today. I'm grateful, you know, for the friends that I have. I'm grateful for my sponsor, and I'm grateful for the home group that I have, because we're based on, you know, sponsorship and service. You know, I got a chance to go to the convention here in our own state, you know, and I wasn't gonna miss that, you know. And I was there for like 5 days, and I volunteered in the headquarters, you know, signing people up for positions and stuff like that. I go to the Atlanta Men's Workshop, you know, for retreats. I even go to our own home group retreats, you know. I went to the Atlanta Roundup. That was good. This is what Jerry, you know, introduced me to come here, you know, and asked me to do this. So I try to do everything today and be in the middle of the bed with AA, you know, because, I mean, this is a miracle that this fellowship is still here, you know, that it even got started, that I have a place to go to, you know, where I feel comfortable. You know, I start out by saying, hi, family. You know, this is home for me. You know, this is my family that I never had growing up. You know, I know they love me, but this is the family that, you know, when I talk to you guys identify what I'm going through. You know exactly what I'm going through, because if I was to talk to an earth person and tell them, listen, I'm having a bad day, you know, and I'm feeling a little screwed up and antsy and stuff like that, I think I need to make a meeting and talk to God and be spiritual and all that kind of stuff, and they would look at me like I was crazy, you know. They don't understand me. They really don't, you know. So where else could I go to do that but, you know, talk to at a meeting, you know, or make a meeting and identify with people, you know, that are in these rooms, you know. I get the opportunity to sponsor guys today, you know. I will say that my sponsor has a sponsor, whose sponsor has a sponsor, and it goes all the way up to Bill S, you know, and I get to sponsor guys today, you know. One of them here tonight, and so that means if I'm like giving somebody suggestions about, you know, how to do this program, I better well know, be doing the same thing, you know, that I'm suggesting that they do. So it's like not being a hypocrite today, because I was pretty much a hypocrite when I was supposed to be going door to door and knocking on people's doors and living a double life, you know. That didn't make me feel good at all, and you know, the more I kept doing that, the more I needed to get, you know, to kill that guilt feeling, you know, and that's what brought me out to drink again, you know. But the reason why I drank again is you couldn't criticize me, and I know that now, you know. I didn't love myself, but if you didn't love me, there was something wrong, you know. If my ex-wife, she said, you're not spending enough time at home, You know, you're not doing what you're supposed to do. And in my perception, I was doing everything right. You know, I was going out in the ministry. I was not smoking. I was not drinking. I wasn't doing any of those things. And we go out on trips and all of that kind of stuff. And here she comes saying, I'm not doing enough. You know, and I don't know if that says anything about if I was doing it or not, or if that was just what women do. I'm going to stay away from that one. But that's what it was, you know. And I did not like her telling me that I wasn't doing enough because I thought I was doing good. But she did come back and, like, I think 20 years later and say, you know, I overreacted. And she apologized to me. She made amends to me, you know, on top of all of the things that I did to her with the infidelity and everything, you know, and not being there as a father, you know, as a good provider, you know, all of these things. I'm not that today, you know, I'm not that today. I realize today with the steps, it's more of the first step for me has to be worked perfectly. I can't have any reservations about, you know, my lot in life, you know, how am I gonna do AA, you know, can I or will I drink again, you know, will I be able to be a social crack user? That's not gonna happen, you know. So I'm okay with knowing that, you know, I admitted that I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And today, you know, I'm good, you know. There's no more reservations like it was before, you know. And I realize the second step, you know, I do depend on my higher power, you know, because I did some insane things during my addiction. And I'll still resort back to doing insane things or saying insane things, you know. But I get on the phone and I, you know, I call somebody and I kind of bounce it off with my sponsor. And he definitely puts me on the right path. As far as the relationship that I have with my high power, I pray to him every day, you know, and I ask him to direct my steps and that Jimmy Curry is out of the way of it all, you know, and his will be done, not mine, you know. And then if there's anybody that I can help that during that day, you know, put him in my path, you know. And at night, go over my inventory and see if I stepped on anybody's toes. And that's good for me, because when I came into this program, I had a bag full of potatoes, you know, and that sack weighed me down, you know. The longer I stay sober, I start to unveil and unpack those potatoes, and my load gets light. So now that I'm in recovery, I try not to add any more potatoes to that sack, you know, so I got a light load. That's not original. I stole everything, except for my story. But the fourth step, which I never worked this until this time around, and I did my fifth step, that was the unleashing of all of that crap that was inside of me, you know. That was the peace and serenity that I had been searching for, you know, that I can let go of all of those resentments and then feel, and this is the biggest thing, that I was wrong in some of that, you know, and mostly all of it, you know, that I can take the part, you know, and blame myself for the part that I played in it, you know. And I mean, humiliating, but you know, kind of made me feel humble for a bit, you know. And then now it's just about asking God to remove those character defects of being too much of an overachiever or being an image guy or being, you know, a guy that needs attention, you know. I have to work on that too daily. We're going to start making our financial amends when I get a job. Right now I'm not working, you know, but I don't stress about money today, you know, because my faith tells me that God will provide today. You know, I don't have to go out there and, you know, kind of hustle and do things that I'm not supposed to be doing. You know, I do the next right thing, and I put my right foot in front of the other. And, you know, as long as I put towards, you know, making it happen, God will do the rest, you know. But he doesn't want me resting on my laurels or sitting on my butt, you know, not doing anything to put towards getting a job, you know. I always have somebody telling me, you gotta work at getting a job and do it like 40 hours a week, like you don't have a job, like you have a job, you know. So that's what I do today. And so I stayed in conscious contact with my higher power, you know, and do my inventory and all that kind of stuff. And I try to be the best person that I can possibly be today. What more can anybody ask of me? You know, I demand it out of myself to be the best person I can do, you know, be today. And that helps me at the end of the day to have a clean conscience, you know. Even in sales, I mean, I worked 20 years in sales. You know, I wasn't one of those salespersons that was unethical. You know, I always went to sleep with a good kind, you know, with a good head. You know, I wasn't lying to them, being too persuasive and too manipulative. Not even too, just manipulative or persuasive. You know, I did the best thing that I, the possible thing that I can do, because for me, sales just helped me to put me in line with having sponsees. You know, you create a need and you fulfill that need, and you just help people do that. And I love sales, you know, but I just, you know, I just wanted to change my careers with school now, and I don't want to have that stress on me all day, every day, you know. I think that we're almost at the end of, you know, this story, and I want to appreciate you guys for letting me share.